Speak. I want to talk about constructing number fields and function fields with prescribed class group properties. I should say I'm not really a computational number theorist, but I will try to focus on the more explicit constructions type of results. So I'm going to talk more about function fields than number fields, so let me just start out with a few preliminaries. We're going to let Q be a power of an odd prime, FQ is the finite field with Q elements, T can be any transcendental element over FQ, so that little k is the rational function field in T. The polynomial ring we'll call A. You always want to think of sort of the analogy between that and the integers, and of course the quotient field, the rational function field with the rational numbers. And if K is any finite extension of little k, then we call K a global function field, and I'm only going to be talking about function fields over these finite fields. So one difference between number fields and function fields that comes up a lot is the prime at infinity. So just like in the integers, we have this one extra prime, so we have the valuations corresponding to the finite primes or the monic irreducible polynomials, and then there's one more which we say corresponds to the prime at infinity. Technically, the infinity is the localization of the polynomial ring in 1 over t at 1 over t, or at infinity of f over g is just the degree of g minus the degree of f, and so on. Okay, so I want to study the ideal class group. So on the left we have the number field situation, on the right we have the function field situation. In either case, OK is going to denote the ring of integers, which is just the integral closure of either Z or FQ of T inside capital K, and we'll denote the ideal class group of OK by CL sub K. So in function fields, of course, we have the divisor class group of degree zero as well, but mostly, and depending on time, almost always, I'm going to be talking about the ideal class group. So unless I specifically say divisor class group, I always mean the ideal class group. Okay, so the main question I want to look at is, can we construct number fields and function fields, preferably infinitely many, whose class groups have certain properties? So this is a very old question, of course, the class number one problem. I won't be saying anything about that one. Some other things, though, that we can say things about are, when is the class number divisible by a given integer n? When is the class number indivisible by a given integer n? Less is known about that one. Can we find number fields or function fields who have a specific class group G for some given finite abelian group G? Or maybe an easier question is, can we find number fields or function fields with class groups having a subgroup G? And in talking about subgroups, we'll be talking about the n rank of the class group. So for a given integer n, we say that the class group has n rank r if r is the greatest positive integer such that r copies of z mod nz are sitting inside the class group. So, of course, the study of this question goes back to Gauss, who was working with equivalence classes of binary quadratic forms, and he proved that Q adjoining the square root of D has even class number if and only if D is divisible by at least two distinct primes. More specifically, Q root D has two rank R minus 1 if R is the number of distinct primes dividing D. That's true if D is negative, so that's true for imaginary quadratic number fields, and it's off by one maybe if it's a real quadratic number field, depending on what the norm of the fundamental unit is. Okay, so that's for two. For class number divisible by a general integer n at least three, in 1922, Nagel proved that infinitely many imaginary quadratic number fields have class number divisible by n. Ankeny and Chawla also proved a similar result in 1955, which comes up a lot in later work, which is why I mention it here. In 1970, Yamamoto proved the corresponding result for real quadratic number fields, and Weinberger obtained a similar result just a few years after that. For function fields, it wasn't until 1991 that a similar result was proven by Chris Friesen. So that's infinitely many, but you might ask, can we do better than that? So the Cohn and Lunstra heuristics predict that we should have more than infinitely many. We should in fact have a positive density of fields with class number divisible by n. So their predictions are based on the fact that a finite abelian group G appears to occur as the class group of an imaginary quadratic field with a frequency inversely proportional to the size of the automorphism group. And similar similar reasoning for the real quadratic number fields as well. So in particular, they predict that the number of imaginary quadratic number fields with class number divisible by an odd prime p is 1 minus the product from 1 to infinity of 1 minus 1 over p to the I, and a similar conjecture for real quadratic number fields. So their paper was for quadratic number fields. However, their ideas were generalized to number fields of any degree and over any base field by Cohen and Martinet a few years later, and there's a function field analog by Friedman and Washington a few years after that. So lots of computational evidence to support these heuristics as well as the reasoning, but very little has actually been proven along these lines. In 1971, Davenport and Heilbronn have a result on class number divisible by 3, which agrees with their predictions. And Jeff Achter has a recent result similar to what Friedman and Washington conjecture for function fields. So we don't have much progress as far as definite proofs toward Cohen and Lonstra, but in the past several years, several quantitative results have appeared, which are sort of a step in the right direction. So still zero density, but better than infinitely many. So if you look at how many number fields or function fields have discriminant less than or equal to a given number x and have class number divisible by n, we have these results on lower bounds. So Ron Marcy was the first to get one of these quantitative results in 1999. He showed that the number of imaginary quadratic number fields with absolute discriminant less than or equal to x and class number divisible by n is greater than a positive constant times x to the 1/2 plus 1 over n. Ankeny and Chawla's result, they don't actually mention this, but they do get a lower bound of x to the 1/2 for the imaginary case in their paper. For real quadratic fields, if n is odd or n is exactly divisible by 2, then we get a lower bound of x to the 1 over 2n minus epsilon. If n is divisible by 4, there's a similar lower bound. It's just not quite as good. Murty and Cardin have a similar result for the quadratic function field case. So if q is a power of an odd prime, n at least 3, the number of quadratic function fields of the form fq of t adjoin the square root of d, where degree of d is less than or equal to x and class number divisible by n is at, is greater than a positive constant times q to the x times 1/2 plus 1 over n. So we see that x has been replaced by q to the x. Okay, and then in the several years since then, we have lots of improved bounds. So for imaginary quadratic number fields, those top two bounds are by Sounder and Rajan. If n is divisible by 4, we get 1/2 plus 2 over n minus epsilon. So the 1 over n became a 2 over n. And if 4 divides n minus 2, we have x to the 1/2 plus 3 over n plus 2 minus epsilon. For real quadratic number fields, for a general odd integer n, you obtained a bound of x to the 1 over n minus epsilon. And for n equals 3, we get even better results by Chakra, Bortine, Murty, and Bion and Co. For real quadratic function fields, Chakraborty, and I'm not going to pronounce that name because I'm sure I'll say it wrong, we get q to the x over n over x squared and q to the x over 2n. So those are all for quadratic fields, number fields, and function fields. For higher degree extensions, less is known. For number fields, the best result for higher degree extensions is this by Bilou and Luca. And so this is for any degree extension m and class number divisible by n, m is at least 3, and we get a lower bound of x to the 1 over 2 over m minus 1n. And so for m equals 2, we see we get a lower bound of x to the 1 over 2n, which is a slight improvement. So that's for number fields. For a higher degree function fields, we have the following result, which is just a generalization of Murty and Cardone's original work. So if L is a prime number dividing q minus 1, n is a fixed positive integer satisfying three properties. So we want n to be big enough, so in particular greater than L squared minus L. We need n to have no prime divisors less than L, and then we want 1 over L minus 1 over n to be greater than log 2 over log q. So under those conditions, we get a lower bound of q to the x times 1 over L plus 1 over n cyclic extensions. where the degree of D is less than or equal to X and the class number is divisible by N. And I should say in all these results I've been mentioning, we do actually construct the field. Okay, so those three properties seem kind of restrictive on N. However, as long as Q is big enough, even if N doesn't satisfy the three properties, we still get a lower bound. It's just not quite as good. The 1 over N becomes 1 over NT for some integer T. And you can figure out what T is based on what you're working with. So to prove this, there's sort of two parts. First, you want to actually construct an element of order N, so you know the class number is divisible by N, and then you need to count the field. So I'm not going to talk about the counting methods involved, but just about how do we construct the field. So the idea of the proof is as follows. If we take two monic polynomials, F and G, and we need the degree of G to the L to be strictly bigger than the degree of F to the N, and we take some constant A, not a unit, such that minus A is not an Lth power, then we can define D to be G to the L minus A F to the N, and our field will be FQ of T adjoined. That should be the Lth root of D, not the square root of D. And that's going to be our field with class number divisible by N. Okay, so that's how we get our fields, and we just need to use sieve methods to sort of figure out how many F and G are going to give rise to Lth power free D, and then check for duplication, since different pairs of F and G will give rise to the same field. Okay, so how do we get our element of order N in the class group? Well, remember, L was a prime dividing Q minus 1, so that means we have a primitive Lth root of unity zeta in our base field. So we can factor D, which is, remember, G to the L minus AF to the N. We can factor it as follows into a product of linear factors. So thinking of those as ideals, not just elements, it's not hard to see that the ideals on the right are pairwise relatively prime, and of course their product is an nth power, so that means each one is individually an nth power. So we know there's some ideal A whose nth power is equal to the principal ideal generated by G minus the Lth root of D. So we know that A has order dividing N. We want to show that A has order exactly N. So let's let R be the exact order of A in the class group, and we're going to show that R equals N. Okay, so if the order of A is R, then A to the R is a principal ideal, so let V denote the element that generates that ideal, an element that generates the ideal. So if I use the notation absolute value, that's just the size of the residue class, OK mod B, for some ideal B. So we have that factorization. We can look at the norm of the ideal, the principal ideal generated by F to the N, in two ways. So on the one hand, it's equal to the norm of the product on the right. We know that G minus Lth root of D, that's just A to the N. Now, each of those terms on the right, each of those ideals are conjugates, so they have the same norm. So we get that's equal to the norm of A to the N all to the L. But this is a principal ideal generated by F to the N. We're in a degree L extension, so it's also equal to Q to the NL degree of F. So that tells us that the norm of the principal ideal generated by V, in other words, the norm of A to the R, is Q to the R degree of F. So we're going to need that in just a minute. So one step of the proof, which I won't go through the details of, is to show that the degree of the norm of V is at least equal to 1 over L minus 1 times the degree of D. So that's not too hard. It's just a little bit technical, so I don't want to spend the time on it. So if we look at Q to the R degree of F, as we just showed on the previous slide, that's the norm of A all to the R, or the norm of the principal ideal generated by V, which is, of course, the absolute value of the norm of V, which is Q to the degree of the norm of V. Given that inequality, that's at least equal to Q to the degree of D over L minus 1. D was G to the L minus AF to the N, just by definition. And remember, we chose F and G so that the degree of F to the N was bigger, so that degree on top is just N degree of F. So we see that N over R is less than or equal to L minus 1. Okay, so N over R is an integer dividing N. It's less than L. Therefore, it must be equal to 1 by our hypothesis that N has no prime divisors less than L. So we get that N equals R, which is what we wanted. Okay, so that's how we get the order element of order N in the class group. And again, I don't want to go through the details of how we count how many F and G we get to get that lower bound. Okay, so that's class number divisible by n. More generally, we can talk about n rank in quadratic number fields or quadratic function fields. So divisibility by n is just n rank 1, so now we want to look for higher n rank. So the Cohen and Lunster conjectures predict the positive density of fields with class number divisible by n. They also say something about the n rank. So in particular, the probability that the odd part of the class group of an imaginary quadratic field is cyclic is almost 98%. So although many fields should have class number divisible by n, it's going to be much harder to find fields of high n rank. In particular, if we want the probability that the p rank is equal to r, and this is all for an odd prime p, we get that product there. So you can see as the rank goes up, it's harder and harder to get fields. So what's known? Yamamoto, in the paper I mentioned before, where he showed that infinitely many imaginary quadratic number fields, he showed that infinitely many real quadratic number fields have class number divisible by n, he obtained a stronger result for imaginary fields and showed that infinitely many have n rank at least 2, and that's for any n. So that was in 1970. The special case when n equals 3 has been studied a lot more. So Craig shows that there are infinitely many imaginary quadratic number fields with 3 rank at least 3. I believe that's the best if we ask for infinitely many. Diaz Udia?
How do you have the result
for infinitely many?
I thought so.
Oh, maybe he does. I could be wrong. He definitely has at least finitely many for 3 rank 4, but it might be infinitely many. Diaz Udia's has an algorithm for generating quadratic fields with 3 rank at least 2. We're just talking about number fields right now. The current record, I believe, is 3 rank 6. Only 3 such fields. Again, not infinitely many. For 5 rank, Mestre has infinitely many real and imaginary quadratic number fields with 5 rank at least 3. That result's not constructive. He uses sort of the Neron model of an elliptic curve and generates 3 independent degree 5 abelian unramified extensions of the given quadratic field. And then using Maestro's, a similar technique, people have found some examples of fields with, I think, 7 rank and 11 rank equal to 2 or 3, but just finitely many as far as I know. Okay, so we already know that there's infinitely many quadratic number fields with 3 rank at least 2, but I'm going to mention this result anyway. This was due to my undergraduates the summer before last at the REU at Williams College. We already knew there were infinitely many, but this is sort of a nice, very explicit construction. If w is any integer plus or minus 1 mod 6, and c is congruent to w mod 6, if we let d be that big polynomial, kind of a mess, then q root d has 3 rank at least 2. And we get infinitely many real fields from this and infinitely many imaginary. And we're actually going to be able to use this result to get a lower bound on the number of fields with 3 rank at least 2. We can also generalize that result. So this is with Florian Lucca. If we choose integers a and b such that a is 1 mod 30 and b is 11, or vice versa, and then we choose integers alpha and beta, positive, satisfying those congruences and GCD conditions, once we've chosen that, if we let d be this even longer polynomial in a, b, alpha, and beta, which doesn't quite fit on one line, then q root d has 3 rank at least 2 in this situation as well. So again, already knew infinitely many, but it's just sort of a nice simple computation. So let me give you an idea of what the proof is like, because I believe that'll generalize to 3 rank 3 as well. So we're going to use class field theory. So remember, the Hilbert class field H of K is just the maximal unramified abelian extension of K, and that the class group of K is isomorphic to the Galois group of H over K. So we see that 3 is going to divide the class number of K if and only if there is some cyclic unramified degree 3 extension of K. And more particular, due to Hesse, we know that the 3 rank of K is n if and only if there are exactly 3 to the n minus 1 over 2 cyclic unramified extensions of K of degree 3. So if there's class number is divisible by n and the 3 rank is exactly 1, then there's just going to be one such extension. But if the 3 rank is at least 2, we'll have at least 4 such extensions. And so a main ingredient of the proof is going to be this result of Kishi and Miyake, who actually showed exactly when the class number of a quadratic number field is divisible by 3. So if you choose integers u and w, and we define this polynomial g of z as follows in terms of u and w. As long as these conditions are met, so we want 4uw cubed minus 27u squared to not be a square in z, u and w need to be relatively prime, g of z should be irreducible, then if you look at the splitting field of that polynomial, it's going to be degree 6, and it'll be a degree 3 cyclic unramified extension of q adjoined the square root of d. So q adjoined the square root of d is going to have class number divisible by 3 in that case. And conversely, every quadratic number field k with class number divisible by 3 and every unramified cyclic cubic extension of k is going to be given by a suitable choice of integers u and w. So we're going to use this theorem to construct our extensions. So here are the parameterizations. Remember, we chose a, b, alpha, and beta. Just define u, v, x, and y in terms of those integers. C is also defined in terms of those integers. I didn't write down what that was. And then we see that the pairs u and v, not u and w, sorry, and x and y are both going to satisfy the hypotheses for Cauchy and Miyake theorem. So it looks like we have these two quadratic extensions. Each one has class number divisible by 3. But because of the way we chosen our u, v, x, and y, it's actually the same quadratic field. So we have these two pairs, u, v, x, and y. Every time you see a v or a w, they're the same thing, apparently. So we have these fields, q of theta 1, q of theta 2, which are obtained just by adjoining one root of this polynomial. We know these are degree 3 extensions. They're non-Galois. If we look at the Galois closures, L1 and L2, because of Cauchy Miyake's theorem, they're both unramified extensions of Q root D. And so all we need to do is check that they're in fact not the same extension, and that'll show that Q root D has 3 rank at least equal to 2. And it's possible to show that there's a prime number that decomposes differently in each one of those, and that's how we know that they're different. Okay, so that's 3 rank at least 2. We can also get a quantitative result. So I mentioned some lower bounds towards Cohen and Lunstra. Again, not proving Cohen and Lunstra, but giving lower bounds on the number of fields with bounded discriminant and class number divisible by n. There are many fewer bounds for n rank at least 2. The only bound I know of other than this is Bion has a result very recently on the number of imaginary quadratic number fields with n rank at least 2. This is just for 3 rank at least 2, and this actually doesn't use the more general theorem I stated. It just uses the statement that my students proved. So we get a lower bound here of x to the 1 over 3 minus epsilon real quadratic fields with class number, sorry, with n rank at least 2 for n equals 3, and we get the same bound for imaginary number fields as well. Before I talk about n-ranking quadratic function fields, I should just say that I believe we can use similar techniques to come up with infinitely many with 3 rank 3 as well. So if you have 3 rank 3, you're going to have 13 such extensions. You would only need at least 5 to be guaranteed 3 rank 3, but if you also specify certain ramification conditions, you can get away with 3. And so I think we can get that. That same result should also hold in the function field case. One of my students is finishing the details of that. Bauer, Jacobson, Lee, and Scheidler have an algorithm for generating quadratic function fields with 3 rank at least 2. And joint work again with one of my students, Matt Spencer, infinitely many real and imaginary quadratic function fields with n rank at least 2, and that's for a general integer n. Okay, so I want to move on to higher degree extensions because less is known about that. So let's go back to number fields for the moment. So we want to look at n rank, as high n rank as possible, for higher degree extensions. So Azuwada and Ishimura have the following result from 1982. For any positive integers m and n, m greater than 1, there are infinitely many number fields capital K of degree m, which we write as usual as R1 plus 2R2. R1 is the number of real embeddings of K into C, where R2 is at least 1, and the n rank is at least equal to R2. So we don't say anything about the totally real case, but we are getting infinitely many fields of a fixed degree m. So other results in the past, if you wanted high n rank, you often let the degree of the extension grow as well. Yeah, question?
So are you allowed to fix R1 and R2 as long as R2 is at least 1, or do you not have any control over
We definitely have control with the next result of Nakano. I can't remember if we have control with this one. So one way to look at this also is we see that this is, since the R2 and the R1 are involved, this shows sort of a relationship between the N rank and the unit rank. So in this case, we're saying that the N rank plus the unit rank is at least equal to 1 less than the degree of the extension. So Nakano improved this result a couple years later to say something about the totally real case and improve the rank in general. So Azuwada and Ishimura's result is on top just for comparison. Nakano showed that for any positive integers m and n and any R1 and R2 such that R1 plus 2R2 is equal to m, we get infinitely many number fields capital K of fixed degree m such that, again, R1 is what you think it is, and the n rank here is at least R2 plus 1. So now we have the n rank plus the unit rank as at least m. Okay, so modest improvement only going up by 1, but when you think about what the Cohen and Leinster conjectures predict, that's not so surprising that just to get an increase by 1, the proof turns out to be a lot more complicated. Okay, so for a function field analog, we can see that we're probably going to have to look at the unit rank, since we don't have R1 and R2 anymore for real and imaginary function fields, but it does make sense to talk about the unit rank. So Dirichlet's theorem, of course, tells us that the unit rank for a number field is R1 plus R2 minus 1. And for function fields, the unit rank is just 1 less than the number of primes lying over infinity. So if we want to control the unit rank, we're going to control the decomposition of the prime at infinity. And just sort of to complete the analogy, we say that a number field is real if R1 is equal to the degree of the extension. So for a fixed degree M, the highest unit rank you're going to get is when you have a totally real number field. So we'll say that a function field is real if we have the highest unit rank possible in that case, and that's when infinity splits completely, and again we get a unit rank of 1 less than the degree of the extension. So on the opposite extreme, a number field is purely imaginary if the unit rank is m over 2 minus 1, where m is the degree of the extension, and for a given degree m, that's the smallest unit rank we're going to get. So we'll say that a function field is imaginary if we can get the smallest unit rank possible there, which is 0, and that's when we just have one prime lying over infinity. So infinity is either totally ramified or inert. So that's just the two extremes, just so you can see the analogy better, and we have all the other possible behaviors, of course, in between. Okay, so one result for the function fields for the imaginary case. For any relatively prime integers m and n not divisible by the characteristic of fq of t, we get infinitely many function fields of fixed degree m such that the prime at infinity is totally ramified and the n rank is at least equal to m minus 1. Again, the degree is fixed, m. I should also say that these are all geometric extensions. They're also explicit. I'll say a little bit about that later. So again, one sort of trick in the function field case to get higher n rank is you can let the constant field grow, and that helps. But here we're fixing the constant field, so if you sort of added that, you could probably get better n rank. For the other imaginary case, where infinity is inert, that's joint work with Yunjin Lee, and under certain conditions on m, n, and q, we get the same n rank of m minus 1. So both of these, again, if you look at the n rank plus the unit rank, it's at least equal to m minus 1. No, they're not. For the real case, the other extreme behavior, we don't need relatively prime. For any integers m and n, again, not divisible by the characteristic, there are infinitely many function fields of fixed degree m, such that the prime at infinity splits completely, and the n rank is at least 1. So again, much smaller. This is similar to Nakano's result for the totally real case. He just got an n rank of 1. But if you think of it in terms of the n rank plus the unit rank, we're getting that to at least m, which is actually an improvement over the m minus 1. So again, even though the n rank is very small here, the proof is actually more complicated than the previous result. So those are the extreme behaviors. We also have similar results for any possible unit rank. So here's a more general theorem. M and n can be any positive integers, again, not divisible by the characteristic. G can be any integer between 2 and m minus 1. So G is just going to be the number of primes lying over infinity. So we're choosing unit rank G minus 1, where G falls within these bounds. So with the previous two theorems, this gives us any possible unit rank. And we get infinitely many function fields of degree m such that the n rank is at least equal to m minus g, and we get exactly g primes lying over infinity, so exactly unit rank g minus 1. The specific decomposition is given as follows. They all have relative degree 1. One's ramified, the rest are unramified. So again, if you look at this in terms of n rank plus unit rank, this gives us a lower bound of m minus 1. Okay, so natural questions to ask are, can we do this for any possible behavior with a prime at infinity, and how much can we improve that n rank plus unit rank? So with Yoon-Jin Lee, for the case when infinity is inert, we can improve that to m, again, under certain conditions. Yoon-Jin has also improved it to m in two other cases, I believe, under certain conditions on m, n, and q. And again, when I say on certain cases, I mean for a couple different behaviors of the prime at infinity. Not quite every possible behavior yet, though. So let me just say something about the proof. For all those theorems I mentioned, we're going to construct the field using this polynomial f of x. So it's the product from 0 to m minus 1 of x minus b sub I plus d to the n. The b sub i's and d are polynomials in T satisfying certain congruences and degree properties. And again, we can make these all explicit. So depending on how you want infinity to behave, either the b i's and d satisfy these explicit congruence conditions, so you can just choose any that satisfy those properties. For the harder proofs, sometimes you need to define these parametrically in terms of other variables, but again, we can choose those other variables as well. So once we've chosen the b sub i's and our d and we have our polynomial f of x, if we adjoin a root of that polynomial to the rational function field, then that field satisfies the theorem. So that's one, and once you have one, you can get infinitely many, and it's not hard to see that. If you can actually just use the fact that the class number is finite, and we get infinitely many in that way. I want to spend a little more time talking about the behavior of the prime at infinity, but I guess I'll just give you a rough idea about how we construct the subgroup of the class group for one case. So let's let W be the roots of unity in K, E is the group of all the units in K, class group square brackets N is the subgroup of the class group of elements of order dividing N. We're going to work with every prime number L dividing N sort of separately and then put it all together. So we get an exact sequence. Class group square brackets N over L is a subgroup of class group square brackets N. We're going to map that to K star over EK star to the L via H. So if we have an element of class group square brackets N, we have an ideal class A. We'll denote A bar for the class of the ideal A. We know that A to the N is principal, so say it's generated by some element alpha. H is going to map the ideal class of A to the class of alpha in K star over EK star to the L. And you can check that this is well-defined, it's exact, it's a homomorphism, etc. So because the sequence is exact, we get the isomorphism on the bottom. Class group square brackets N to the N over L is isomorphic to that quotient, and that's just isomorphic to the image of H because the sequence is exact. So to get a subgroup of the class group, we're going to get a subgroup in the image of H, and then that gives us a subgroup in class group square brackets N to the N over L. Since this is true for all the prime numbers L dividing N, you can put that together to get a subgroup of the class group, which is what we want. So let me just do the easiest case when infinity is totally ramified, or when infinity is inert. We can just say that E equals W. So the only units we have are the roots of unity. So in that exact sequence that we had on the previous page, we've just replaced E by W, which makes everything easier because a key ingredient of the proof is to show that we have these M minus 1 linearly independent elements, the theta minus the I's, and they're linearly independent in K star over W, K star to the L. So when K does not equal E, you have to do some other things to sort of get back to that group. But when E equals W, things are easier. It's also not too hard to see that the classes of the theta minus bi's are in the image of H. If you just look at the way H was defined, and you remember that theta was the root of our polynomial f of x. So we have these m minus 1 independent elements in the image. So if you just think of everything as a vector space over Z mod LZ, we get that the dimension of class group square brackets n to the n over L is at least equal to m minus 1. And again, as I said, since we can put that together for all the primes L dividing n, then we get our subgroup, which is what we wanted. So I think I will not go through the details of what we do in the more general case, but instead let me say something about how we fix the behavior of the prime at infinity, since the unit rank is important. So when infinity is inert, we also need to use Coomer's criterion, but let me focus on the other cases where the Newton polygon is enough. So let me just remind you, if you don't remember what the Newton polygon is, if A is any discrete rank 1 valuation ring with quotient field K, K bar is going to denote an algebraic closure of K, V is the valuation on A and its extension to K bar. If we have some polynomial f of x, we can just write out in terms of its coefficients the AIs. Then to construct the Newton polygon of F, we're going to plot the points I, comma, ord sub V of AI. And then we're going to draw vertical half lines at all the points, and then you just sort of construct the convex hull of connecting, and you look at the bottom boundary of that. And the main theorem that we care about is this one on the bottom here. If we have two points that are endpoints of a segment of the boundary of the Newton polygon, then that tells us something about the roots. So if I and J are sort of the x-coordinates of those two endpoints, then that tells us that F has J minus I roots in the algebraic closure, counting multiplicity, and the ord is just minus the slope of that line segment. So we can use this theorem to figure out exactly how the prime at infinity behaves just by looking at the coefficients of the polynomial. So in the case that infinity is totally ramified, sorry, the red doesn't come up that great. There's the polynomial again, which we use to construct the extensions. If we want infinity to be totally ramified, all we need is this one condition, that the degree of d to the n is greater than m times the maximum of the degrees of the bi. This is not hard to ensure because the bi's and the d just satisfy congruence conditions, and so we can choose any degree we want. So given that one condition, we can see that the Newton polygon is going to consist of this single line segment. So you can see that the dn wins out over the b to the i's in terms of the degree. So down here, we just have 0 minus n degree d. Over there, it's just m0. And that same condition shows you that all the other points lie strictly above that line or on the line. Now, the fact that m and degree d are relatively prime, combined with the fact that m and n were relatively prime, that was one of the hypotheses for the theorem, we get that we really have an m in the slope of that line segment. So that tells you that the ramification is at least equal to m, but this is a degree m extension, so the ramification is exactly m, so we see that infinity is totally ramified. So we just need that one condition. So totally ramified is the easiest case, and we get the simplest Newton polygon. When infinity splits completely, I can't draw at all, so you'll have to forgive me. We need these two conditions to get that infinity splits completely. Here we're going to have the Newton polygon is going to consist of m distinct line segments, and their slopes are going to be equal to the degrees of the bi's. So to ensure that, we just need that the degree of the bi's are increasing and that their sum is equal to the degree of d to the n, and it's not too hard to see, work out that that's the Newton polygon that we get. For the general case that I mentioned for that particular decomposition behavior, it's sort of a combination of the two. So we have one big line segment, and this is going to correspond to the one ramified prime. The x-coordinate there is m minus g plus 1, and then we have g minus 1 other short line segments, again, equal to the degrees of those greatest bi's. And so we see that the ramification for that one prime is at least equal to m minus g plus 1, because that's in the denominator, but we have g line segments all together, and when you add that up, you get m, so it tells us the behavior is exactly as we claimed. Okay, so that was n rank, higher n rank in higher degree extensions. Let me just say something about a harder question, which is prescribed class group. I'll put the whole slide up. So you can think of n rank, we can sort of do that for different n's, and really it says that as long as the rank of a group is sort of small enough, you can get any finite abelian with that finite abelian group with a small enough rank to appear as a subgroup of the class group. So it's a harder question to say, when can we actually get the group to appear as exactly the class group. So some results in that direction. Yahagi in 1978 proved that every finite abelian P group is isomorphic to the P part of the class group for some number field capital K. In 1998, Engels has a similar result for function fields. Every cyclic group is isomorphic to the class group of infinitely many function fields. He had proved every every other group is a subgroup of the class group for the other ones, but again, this is one of those results where the degree of the extensions was increasing. In 1999, Perret improved this, saying that every finite abelian group G is isomorphic to the S class group of some number field K for some finite set of places S for function fields too. So this is not so surprising, since once we get the group as a subgroup of the class group, then you can sort of just put in the primes that are behaving badly into S, and that's how we get it as appearing as exactly the S part of the class group. None of these fields are explicit constructions. None of these results give explicit constructions of these fields. So as far as I know, these are the best results of this nature. This is sort of a much harder question, but something that definitely deserves to be worked on. So as you can see, the Cohen and Lester conjectures sort of predict that every group should appear as a subgroup of the class group, at least, of some field. So there's not any that shouldn't appear at all. But we do have this result, and I think this is Shafarevich, but I'm not 100% sure on that. If G is a finite abelian group of exponent n, and the size of G is at least equal to that lower bound, then G is not going to be isomorphic to the divisor class group of any global function field. So again, this is different than saying the ideal class group, but this just sort of shows you something different in relation to the Cohen and Lester conjectures. Shafarevich also has a theorem saying that certain groups won't appear as the ideal class group of a field in the case that have prime, but since it's missing on prime, it's not Cohen and Lester. Let me just quickly with indivisible numbers, highlighting them. Trying to put it. Divisible class number harder.